This is Blocked and Reported. I'm Katie Herzog, and sitting in with me today while my very sweaty co-host Jesse Single is waiting in line to be number 42 at Ayla's birthday gangbang, we have Lee Stein. Lee is an author and commentator, and I thought that she came on the show after the publication of her very funny and astute book, Self-Care in 2020. But Lee, I was trying to find a link to that episode for the show notes, and it does not seem to exist. Did I imagine that? Were you not on the show?
Katie, I think you're forgetting that I platformed you when I invited you to my very intimate Zoom event of 100 guests with Jesse and Kat Rosenfield and Phoebe Maltz-Bovey for Self-Care, but it was a debacle because word got out that you had appeared on my Zoom and a professional book critic tattled on me to my book publisher. And I was also kicked out of a networking group for journalists.
Oh, wow. Wow.
For committing guilt by association.
Yes. Let me guess. 2020? Was this 2020?
Summer of 2020. Never forget.
The good old days. I sort of miss that. Well, my apologies for getting that wrong. Welcome to the show for the first time, I guess.
Thank you.
I did have a vague recollection of that draw of the like the post Zoom drama, because I remember buying 10 copies of your book because this person was trying to punish you. And I sent them to like different to people, like the first 10 people who replied to a tweet. And I had one left over and I gave it to my nephew for his third birthday. he might be at the age now when he can read it.
He loves satirical depictions of the wellness industry.
It was a great book, I should say.
Thank you.
Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a book about TikTok.
Oh, all right. You'll have to come back on when that's out.
Yes.
All right. We've got two stories today from the world of literature. Lee, your world. You're going to tell me about a scandal involving, I think, AI and poetry. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. But first, I'm going to tell you about two scandals at the Hugo Awards, one older and one fresh. Lee, how familiar are you with the Hugo Awards?
I feel like this is one of those questions that when I answer it, you're going to tell me what Hogwarts house you're going to sort me into.
So what's the answer?
It's a nerd thing. It's an award for nerds.
Yes, that's correct. You got it. You got it. You get to go into Hufflepuff.
Yes.
So they're basically the Oscars of sci-fi and fantasy writing. They're held annually. They're held at an event called Worldcon. That's the World Science Fiction Convention, and they've been at Worldcon since 1953. I did not know that cons existed in 1953. Apparently they did.
The question is how far back cosplay goes. Like, were they doing cosplay in 1953?
That is a good question. Someone please find out the answer to that and write in. So prior winners include Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Ursula Le Guin, and friend of the pod, J.K. Rowling. She won in 2001 for Harry Potter and the Goblet of Lupron. Great book. But to appreciate this story, you first need to understand how voting at the Hugo Awards works. So there are two stages. There's the nomination stage, and then there's final voting. And the nomination stage, this creates a short list, and all Worldcon members can vote in that first stage. And while Hugo's, they might be the Oscars of the genre, unlike the Oscars, you don't have to be special to participate. You don't have to be invited. So a Worldcon member is anyone who attends that year's Worldcon or someone who pays $50 to be a supporting member. So essentially any nerd with $50 to spare can vote in the Hugo Awards without ever having to leave his mom's basement or her master's dungeon or whatever. There's a subcommittee that oversees the final voting, but the subcommittee members change every year as Worldcon rotates to different sites. And in 2003, so last year, the subcommittee was headed by Mr. Dave McCarty. He's going to come back later.
So in 2023, last year, in 2023.
Yeah, last year. So because nerds are involved, there are some added complexities about how votes are weighted. Surprise, surprise. It's an oddly complex process. I just don't understand, and it doesn't really matter for the purposes of the story. But the important thing to know is that it is possible to game these nominations.
Ooh.
And that brings us, yes, that brings us to our first Hugo-related drama. So several years ago, the Hugos had its own version of Gamergate called The Sad Puppies Affair. Lee, have you ever heard of this?
I'm scared to know more. It's like when you're watching a movie and you have to Google like whether the dog dies before you can watch any further. Like, were any animals harmed in this drama? Okay, good.
Thank God. No, I already cried looking at a TikTok of a dog seeing its owner come home from the grocery store this morning. I can't handle any more dog stories. So this really started in 2013 when a prolific and conservative sci-fi fantasy writer named Larry Coria published a couple of posts on his blog, essentially accusing the Hugos of being elitist and asking his readers to nominate him. And one of those posts included a picture of a sad-looking pug dog, thus the name Sad Puppies. So there had been this running conflict online that really did foreshadow some of the dramas we see today. So basically some more conservative writers, people like Coria, or writers who were more apolitical or just weren't kind of SJW types, they accused the Hugos of awarding books based on politics and identity, particularly progressive politics, over quality writing or even popularity. And so the year after Larry published this Sad Puppies post in 2014, the awards were swept by women and people of color, specifically women and people of color. Like the Candace Owens of the sci-fi world were not winning this. These were people who were thought to have...
let's get some Candace Owens sci-fi. Like it would all be about Jews.
Jewish space lasers. It writes itself.
Yeah.
So the awards were swept by this group that was thought to embody what we would now call wokeness, even though the term didn't exist in that permutation at the time. And so the next year, this group that was now calling themselves the Sad Puppies, they organized to get their own list nominated, and it worked. So in 2015, 51 of their 60 recommendations made the final ballot, and in certain categories, all of the nominees were Sad Puppies choices. So in response to this, no awards in those categories were given out.
So this does actually sound like effective political organizing. Like
yes,
that could the Democrats should learn something from the sad puppies.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does that work? The awards being given out.
So voters can basically choose none of the above on the final ballot, which is what they did. Authors can also withdraw their own works from the awards. This happened a couple times during Sad Puppies as a form of protest. And the Hugo subcommittee can remove nominated works it deems not eligible. That's going to come up again later, not eligible. But regardless, this whole thing kicked up this enormous firestorm with the puppy's ideological enemies labeling it as a sort of anti-diversity campaign, and they were generally very mad about it online. It was the main thing that Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin blogged about on his LiveJournal for a long time. He was rather obsessed with this. He was anti-puppies, which probably won't surprise you. And then it got even weirder when a competing group called Rabid Puppies decided to game the system. This was started by the libertarian writer Vox Day. Have you heard of him?
No. So were the Sad Puppies and the Rabid Puppies aligned?
They were not. The Sad Puppies were fairly serious and earnest about this, and the Rabid Puppies were basically sending a big fuck you to the Hugos. So Vox Day himself, he's a pretty unrepentant racist and apparently a giant asshole. So he called a black sci-fi writer N.K. Jameson. She was one of just five authors to win a Hugo three times. He called her an ignorant half-savage, among other like pretty vile things, yeah. And he was able to organize enough troll votes to get 64 titles on the shortlist, including his own work, which was titled SJWs Always Lie, Taking Down the Thought Police. Very catchy. That had a foreword by Milo Yiannopoulos. Oh, and then also nominated was none other than Chuck Tingle. Lee, I assume you're a fan.
I think he's like the Nora Roberts of butt stuff. Is that right?
This is very true. Just as prolific. Yeah, so he writes gay erotica, extremely prolific. He's written, I believe, over 100 books, and his titles include Slammed in the Butt by the Ever-Living Leftover Chocolate Chip Cookies from My Kitchen Cabinet, Handsome Sentient Food Pounds My Butt and Turns Me Gay, Eight Tales of Hot Food and Beverage Love, Living Inside My Own Butt for 8 Years. That sounds like a Jezebel headline. Oh, these are totally real. Starting a business and turning a profit through common sense reinvestment in strategic targeted marketing. This American Butt, hosted by Ira Ass. Space Raptor Butt Redemption, pounded in the butt by my irrational bigoted fear of humans who were born as unicorns using a human restroom. And slammed in the butt by my Hugo Award nomination because, yes, Chuck Tingle was nominated for a Hugo by the Rabid Puppies as presumably a joke. And then he, of course, immediately churned out some disgusting gay erotica over it.
Thank you for not asking me to read those book titles because my mom might listen to this episode. So.
You know, if Jesse had been here, I would have made him do it. but I respect you.
Yeah, well, you're the Dom.
Thank you.
Okay, so did Chuck Tingle win?
He did not win, but he did get a lot of press and attention. So I guess he did win in that sense. And even some of the anti-puppies like this. So people like Neil Gaiman and John Scalzi. So they were outspoken against the sad puppies and the rabid puppies, but they seem to enjoy his nomination. I'm not sure if this is because they have a good sense of humor or it's because looking at the world through the lens of identity makes people so stupid that terrible pulpy gay erotica about being slammed in the butt is good actually because the author is a homosexual.
It's own voices. It's hashtag own voices.
It is. Exactly. Either way, if the intention was to piss off the SJWs, in this case, it didn't really work. They liked it. Okay, so that was the last big Hugo Awards controversy, but this year's controversy may have been even bigger. So Worldcon moves around each year, and the location is also up for a vote by Worldcon members. It's a real democracy at Worldcon. And each Worldcon attendees can vote on the location of the Worldcon 2 years away. So in 2021, they vote for the location for the 2023 Worldcon. There are no restrictions on where Worldcon can be held, except that it must be at least 500 miles away from the location of the convention where the selection vote happens. Most Worldcons have been in the U.S., and even if they're not in the U.S., they're usually in an English-speaking country. So between 2010 and 2022, 8 Worldcons were in the U.S., and the others were in Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, the U.K., and the only non-English-speaking location in that period was in Finland in 2017. So despite the name, Worldcon is pretty much AmericaCon. Mm. Most members and attendees are American, and they prioritize American texts and locations. But in 2021, something unexpected happened. So Worldcon that year was held in Washington, D.C., and during the conference, there were 2 bids for Worldcon 2023, Winnipeg, Canada, or Chengdu, China. And Worldcon had only been held in Asia once before. It was in Japan in 2007. And considering all this, most people probably would have felt comfortable putting their money on the Canadians to win the bid. They would have lost. Of the nearly 3,000 votes counted, around 2,000 of them were for Chengdu.
Sounds like it's pretty democratic, and people just want China. When you give them the vote, that's China. What the people want.
So the Chinese state-controlled press reported the story very happily, but there were rumblings of discontent. Of the 2,006 votes for Chengdu, 1,950 of them were mail-in votes rather than in-person votes at Worldcon. And this was suspicious even for a pandemic year because there's usually only a handful of mail-in ballots each year. So there were some accusations of Chinese ballot stuffing, particularly from the Canadian contingent. British sci-fi writer Cheryl Morgan, she put it like this in a blog post, quote, "Imagine that you are bidding for a Worldcon in a two-way race. You've seen almost nothing of your opponent in the past year. You then arrive at the mail-in ballot validation meeting to discover that your opponent has a couple thousand votes, filled in electronically, many unsigned and without a home address for the voter, and using email addresses that seem to have been generated automatically. Plus, the way in which these people paid is unusual." So some people were suspicious, but Morgan, in that same blog post, she provides some explanations for why these ballots might have seemed odd but weren't. She writes, quote, "The way in which we in the Western world validate our identity doesn't work as well in China. Street addresses are not a thing the same way they are for us, and many Chinese, particularly younger ones, do not have email addresses. They communicate through social media. Some people had to create email addresses in order to vote." So Jessica, the 80s baby, she did the research on this one. She said that this seems absurd to her. She is very international. She lives in Asia. She spent time in China. She said, "Of course, Chinese people have street addresses. They're formatted differently, but the idea that they don't have them is nonsensical." She also said that Morgan did have a point about the email addresses. Quote, "Chinese people usually have them, but they don't use them that much. And the address will be typically entirely numerical, something like 123456@qq.com, which looks pretty sketchy from a Western point of view."
I'm completely fixated on this detail of the email addresses. I'd never heard of this before. Like, is this true? I knew that China has its own TikTok, but like the fact that it has its own like alternate universe email address system, this is news to me.
That's how good Chinese people are at math.
That they memorize the digits of their friend's email address.
Yes, exactly. In America, we don't even know our own phone numbers. In China, But Morgan's article is a good example of the general reaction among very online Western sci-fi fans. So despite extremely suspicious circumstances, they instinctively defend the Chinese sci-fi community from accusations of ballot stuffing and accuse everyone who is critical of China of racism. So here's the writer Paul Weimer on this. Quote, there has been a lot regarding the Chengdu now winning bid. Some of it has been racially ugly as sin. The apparent attempt by members of the Winnipeg, the competing bid, to push an interpretation of the World Science Fiction Society Constitution regarding voting information in order to potentially disqualify a large number of ballots for the Chinese bid is frankly reprehensible. Other areas of the sci-fi fantasy internet have just gone full-bore Red Scare racist, implying or saying that the CCP, the Communist Party of China, has, quote, bought a Worldcon. That in itself is nonsense. And here's the author, Darren, well, definitely going to mispronounce that one. Do you know how to do umlauts?
Coonskin.
Coonskin. That sounds problematic. Here's the author, Derek Coonskin, drawing an interesting parallel. Would there be political issues for some people? Undoubtedly, some people, for reasons of politics or principle, would decide not to go to a Chinese Worldcon. I think it is important to note that as a Canadian, I and many friends are already thinking twice about crossing into the USA for Worldcon since about 2010, and many already decide not to participate in sci-fi fandom if it involves travel to the US.
Since 2010, he's been scared to come to the United States?
Those were the Obama years. Do you think he's just racist?
It's because of the skin color of our president in 2010, mm-hmm. for sure.
So he wrote that post in 2019. And I hope I'm not misreading this, but I think he was saying that China in 2019, when the government was cracking down on pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong and keeping a million Uyghurs in concentration camps, was somehow less problematic or as problematic as the United States in 2010. Maybe I'm misinterpreting this. That is what it sounds like to me. And he ended that post saying that he would be voting for Chengdu. But not everyone agreed. And in March 2022, sci-fi writers and Uyghur activists wrote an open letter calling for Chinese Worldcon to be canceled because of the Chinese government's ongoing genocide against the Uyghur people. I'm not a sci-fi fan. I don't recognize any of the authors' names, but it's clear that a lot of them are not from white European or American backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Dislike for the CCP is not just a white thing. So one previous Hugo Award winner, Hong Kong-born Jeanette Ng, she tweeted, my Hugo acceptance speeches would have gotten me arrested in China. I have said things on the record that are just illegal. All the hand-wringing and whataboutism in the world isn't going to change that. But nevertheless, despite protests from some quarters, Worldcon Chengdu was not canceled, it was not moved, and it took place in October 2023. And in a remarkable show of restraint from the Chinese government, nobody mysteriously disappeared from the convention. So cheers to them for that. Yes.
Wow. Clap. Yes.
The Human Rights Foundation did condemn Worldcon after the event had finished, but there were no mass boycotts. And in fact, the real drama only started a couple months after it was over. And it didn't have anything to do with the Uyghurs, who, for the record, are not white guys who wear do-rags and listen to Dr. Dre. Thank you for laughing at that. So the drama started on January 20th, 2024, when the Hugo Awards published the nomination statistics for the 2023 ceremony. So this is after the ceremony was over. That in itself was unusual because the statistics are usually made public the night of the awards ceremony. And what's more, the document contained a few surprises. Specifically, four works had been declared not eligible with no explanation given. Those writers included Neil Gaiman, Paul Weimer, Rebecca F. Kwong, and Zirin J. Zhao, who you might remember as the writer who unmasked Kate Corin in the Goodreads review scandal a couple months ago. So the latter two writers are both ethnically Chinese. Both were born in China and immigrated as children, Kwong to the States and Zhao to Canada. And Neil Gaiman, he's spoken in the past about Chinese government censorship. So immediately,
and I would just butt in and say, this is where I started to hear about the story for real, because yeah. I'm interested in Rebecca Kwong, and she is like smarter than any of us. She's like 27 years old and she's written 5 books and gone to Oxford and she's getting a PhD at Yale. Ugh, she's like a genius.
I
and
hate
her Yellow Face is really good.
But does she have a podcast, Lee?
She does not.
Okay. Okay.
Point for Katie.
So So immediately people online started to speculate that the Hugo Awards subcommittee had caved to CC pressure to censor these writers. So the head of this year's subcommittee, that's Dave McCarty, I mentioned earlier, he's been involved in the Hugo Awards for many years, and he refused to answer any kind of explanation despite growing demands that he tell people what the fuck happened. This became a big thing on Facebook, and while the relevant Facebook page has disappeared, according to a report on this from Esquire, he responded to people who were questioning what happened with comments like, "Are you slow?" and "Clearly you can't understand plain English in our constitution."
That's really showing great leadership.
Yes, that is the exact messaging you want. So Paul Weimer, he's the one who in that earlier blog post defended the choice to hold WorldCon in China and said that those who disagreed were Red Scare racist. He'd been nominated for best fan writer and he was pissed about this, obviously, because, you know, he was ineligible. So he posted this on his Patreon, quote, "Okay, his writing is like is incredibly bad to me. It's hard
what
to
parse. What does it mean? What's best fan writer? It's like that means most beloved?
I guess so. Or like most rabid fan.
Oh, the writer who's the best fan.
I don't think that's what it means. So he wrote, quote, "Okay, a more serious question, Dave McCarty, and here is something I deserve to know. If the Chengdu World Con declared me ineligible at the direction of political or government parties outside the con, I forking need to know that. The company I work for has an assembly plant in China, fun fact, and if the company can't ever think of sending me there because I might get arrested when I get off the plane, I need to know and they need to know." I like the idea that he would go assemble fork somewhere.
Why is a professional writer like being so corny and saying, "I forking need to know that"? Like, who is censoring his Patreon? Like, who are the censors looking over his shoulder?
His mom? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess. So, Katie, do we find out what made best fan writer Paul Weimer, like, why were these writers deemed ineligible?
Yes, we did find out thanks to a whistleblower named Diane Lacey. She was on the subcommittee herself, and she leaked a trove of subcommittee emails to journalists Chris M. Barkley and Jason Stanford. They are from an outlet called File 770. These emails were also posted online. She also posted an apology letter because it turns out that the subcommittee did not actually bow to pressure, and in fact, they themselves were the censors. Yes.
What? Yes.
So Diane's letter begins. "Let me start by saying I am not making excuses. There are no adequate excuses. I am thoroughly ashamed of my part in this debacle, and I will likely never forgive myself. But the fans that have supported the Hugo's nominees and those that were unfairly and erroneously deemed ineligible in particular deserve an explanation. Perhaps the only way I can begin to ease my conscience is to provide one."
I actually relate to Diane Lacey in this story. I feel like I would be the one to be like, "I'll tell you everything." Like, I would just, I would crumble under the pressure and just like leak everyone's emails.
Yes.
So no one tell me secrets.
No one is holding a gun to your head.
No one tell me secrets over email. Like, just tell me secrets like in person. So what was in these emails that she shares?
It was pretty damning. And it looked as though rather than the CCP leaning on the subcommittee, the pressure to censor was coming from Hugo Awards Administrator Dave McCarty himself, and the Chinese members of the committee were excluded from these emails. So, for instance, here was one email that Dave McCarty sent the group. Quote, "We need to highlight anything of a sensitive political nature in the work. It's not necessary to read everything, but if the work focuses on China, Taiwan, Tibet, or other topics that may have been an issue in China, that needs to be highlighted so we can determine if it is safe to put on the ballot or if the law will require us to make an administrative decision about it."
Can I just interject here and just say it's so interesting to me because in my like creative writing world that we're going to talk more about today, it's like everyone talks about how all art is political, that you can't separate politics from art. Mm-hmm. And so for this guy to say like we need to highlight anything of a sensitive political nature in the work, I think that the people in my world would say like you can't separate the politics from the art. It's all political.
Everything is, yeah. Is it the personal is political or the political is personal? One of those slogans applies
here. Both.
So the emails also show that the subcommittee members trawled through nominees' Twitter histories looking for anything negative they might have said about China. And they show that many of the committee members didn't actually read the works in question. Instead, they flagged anything that mentioned China at all. So for example, Paul Weimer, he was apparently flagged for once visiting Tibet, although he hadn't actually been to Tibet. He once went to Nepal.
This is such a white person. confusion. Such a white person mistake.
He was also flagged because while he supported holding the conference in Chengdu, he also criticized the Chinese government. And he once wrote a positive review of a book that he said took, quote, one of the pillars of Chinese literature and reinvented it in a queer feminist retelling of an important and nation-defining story. Very problematic. So that's why he was excluded. Zirin J. Zhao, her book was flagged because it drew inspiration from a Chinese goddess.
So offensive. So yes. Offensive.
Yes. And Rebecca F. Kuang, her book Babel, or The Necessity of Violence. Her book focuses on an alternative history of the Opium Wars. The Opium Wars were between the UK and China, but her book was largely critical of the UK, not China. And that book, huge bestseller. It had 810 nominations for the Hugo Awards. So well more than enough to make the shortlist.
Yeah, that's. I think that was the really like fan favorite. Like that was the one that everyone assumed would win and that it was deemed ineligible.
Mm-hmm.
It's big on TikTok. Did we find out why the subcommittee was self-censoring if the Chinese Communist Party wasn't pressuring them to censor, as people believed?
So the emails didn't really spell that out, but Diane Lacey told File 770, quote, the things that were marked ineligible, was it local pressure from the government or was it business interest? I can't answer that. From my knowledge, I would probably say business interest.
And what about Dave McCarty, our honorable leader? What who told us that we don't understand English? What
is slow?
What did he say? What's his comment?
Yeah, so he agreed to an interview with File 770 as well. They posted the whole transcript of that, and he seems contrite. Like he says the CCP wasn't implicated except, quote, insofar as the government says what the laws are in the country. So the government of China says what's cool in China and the people just operate inside of the bounds of what's cool, which is exactly the same way you and I work here.
What a great way to describe like the Chinese government. Like, listen, the Chinese government, they tell you what's cool and then you just do what's cool based on what they tell you.
Just like here.
So chill. So
yeah,
chill.
It's very chill. So it's kind of a mealy mouth excuse to me, but maybe a more generous reading would be like, look, the laws in China are vague. You never know what's going to get the government's attention. So just to be on the safe side, we'll eliminate anything and anyone that could potentially be a problem. But regardless, after this, a new narrative developed in the sci-fi fandom. The Hugo Awards subcommunity was now even worse than the CCP because they had chosen to preemptively self-censor, not because the pressure was coming from China itself. It was just these committee members anticipating some kind of pressure. So Chris Barkley and Jason Stanford, the journalists who published the report, they wrote this. What also disturbs me is that the administrators of the Hugo Awards from the United States and Canada, countries that supposedly support and value free speech, appear to have been active participants in the censorship. Let me say that again because there are too many people who believe that this happened solely because of the Chinese government. The administrators from the United States and Canada appear to have helped censor the Hugo Awards. Naturally, there haven't been many posts by actual current Chinese citizens in China discussing the whole affair because they live under one of the most repressive regimes on earth. But there was one take from a Chinese sci-fi fan who called it a post-colonial tragedy and wrote, I have nothing to say except to feel ashamed when such a post-colonial magical scene occurs in a socialist country committed to independence and autonomy.
Wait, can we pause and close read this text? Because
yes,
is this sarcasm or is this someone who's saying that they honestly believe that their socialist country is committed to independence and autonomy?
My guess is that this is someone who is either terrified of being drug out of his house and taken to the gulag.
Got it.
Or someone who maybe works for the CCP. One or the other.
I'm just so used to like irony on the internet that when I read like someone who's like sincere, it's like confusing to me.
I mean, or it could be just dripping with sarcasm. I honestly can't tell.
Yeah.
It's also worth looking at the reactions from the two Chinese-born writers who were disqualified. So in the case of Rebecca F. Kuang, she said nothing. She's critically acclaimed, best-selling author. She hasn't used Twitter in a half a year, so maybe that's how she gets so much shit done. Her agent is refusing requests to comment. But our old pal, Zirin J. Zhao, she is terminally online, and she's been kicking up a fuss, as you might expect. I first saw this on a post on Instagram for her. She's been accusing Dave McCarty of fiddling the numbers and removing votes from Chinese people so that Western writers would win. She called him a, quote, mediocre white man determined to make the first Hugos held in Asia to be the most racist ever. These were not, by the way, the first Hugos held in Asia.
Dave McCarty is the Donald Trump of this narrative.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. just trying to get the votes to align with the outcome that he
just
wants.
Just find the votes. Or maybe she's them. Maybe she's the Donald Trump in this scenario.
They both can be. They can share the title. Oh, what about our blogger, our number one fanboy, Paul Weimer? Has he commented on this?
Okay, so he said this on his Patreon. So aside from the fact that you as patrons know I went to Nepal and not Tibet, we come down to the fact that I was declared ineligible on McCartney and Company's conception of wanting to protect their Chinese friends. And you will note from Sanford and Barclay's report and the emails that it seems this wasn't entirely a North American thing and they didn't consult the Chinese at all. So paternalistic Orientalism as spur to censorship. I don't think you can say Orientalism anymore. But this take has been very common on social media, particularly in the very online US-based sci-fi fantasy community. So you have Dave McCarty, a Westerner, imposing his concept of what's appropriate on these awards. He excluded the Chinese members of the community from these discussions. This was almost, to some people, a form of imperialism. But I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem crazy to me to fear CCP intervention. China has extremely ruthless state censorship, but there's no official comprehensive list of things you can or cannot write or speak about. And that in itself exacerbates a climate of fear. So I asked a writer who lived in China about this, and he said, quote, "The lack of a clear red line, particularly online, makes CCP censorship more effective since it encourages a culture of self-censorship. There's direct repression too, of course, there being some obvious no-goes, Tibet, Taiwan, Tiananmen, but then lots of gray zone. Being left in that gray zone leaves you vulnerable as a writer or intellectual." He also said that historically, sci-fi and fantasy have been a, quote, "dynamic genre in China in no small part because it allows for a bit of creativity and imagination that can plausibly push the boundaries of what is acceptable to discuss in the PRC, that's People's Republic of China. He mentioned the writer Chan Kuncheng, whose first novel was about a, quote, "artificially happy future Chinese utopia where a euphoric drug was put in the water supply that also had the effect of causing amnesia about a violently repressive event in the country's past." So this was published outside the country, but it was passed around inside the country. The writer could speak at festivals, appear in some liberal media publications, etc. And he said, "this is a testament to how much things have changed in the past 10 years or so. Sadly, unimaginable today." So I don't know. I mean, tell me what you think, Lee, but I don't think that Dave McCarty was totally nuts for assuming that certain topics or authors would be verboten in China. And if those were celebrated, that the Chinese members of the committee could, in fact, be in danger. Like, he handled this clumsily for sure. But it seems to me that as soon as they accepted China as a location for Worldcon, they were kind of fucked either way. What do you think about this?
I mean, I don't want his job. Like, I wouldn't want to be in that position. But
absolutely not.
The story kind of reminds me of, you know, this kind of like left-wing paranoia that you and Jesse have talked a lot about on the show. It's like the people who don't believe cancel culture exists will say, "what are you talking about? You can say whatever you want." Mm-hmm. Like, there's no one telling you can't say right. something. And yet there are these like cultural enforcers among us saying, you know, it's like there's a censor in my head all the time. Like last night in the State of the Union address, like when Biden kind of lost the script and was responding to Marjorie Taylor Greene and said the word illegal instead of saying undocumented mm-hmm. immigrant, which is what you're supposed, quote unquote, supposed right. to say. Like, I felt this like flare of anxiety in my chest because he's not supposed to say that. Like, my inner censor was triggered. And so we do it even in the United States. We do it to each other. We police what each other says. So that's the part of the story that I feel like resonates more broadly.
Do you think that is changed at all in the last couple of years? Like, this is something that I've been asking a lot of the guest hosts. Do you think that whatever you want to call it, wokeness, this culture of fear and self-censorship, do you think it's on the wane?
I hope so. I mean, I agree with Andy Mills.
Yeah.
Did I get that right? Yeah. Just, I don't think Twitter like has a concentration of power the way it did, because now everyone is on so many different social media platforms. There just isn't that, like, you can't assemble a mob as easily.
Yeah, it's dispersed.
So I think that's good news. But I still feel like this residue, like this inner censor, I still have it inside me, even as I kind of try to fight it.
You have epigenetic trauma. from 2020 from getting yelled at for having me and Jesse on your Zoom.
Yeah, I do.
Are you on Blue Sky or Mastodon or any of those?
I refuse to get on Blue Sky, though. Yeah. I liked Helen's summary of what the culture is like over there. That was very funny. No, I refuse to get on Blue Sky. I dabbled in Threads, but it feels to me like all the stupidest people from Twitter went to Threads, and I can't really tolerate it.
Well, I mean, people who are good at so Threads, for people who don't know, is the Meta clone. So you access it. It's a different app, but you can access it through Instagram or Facebook. And people who are naturally good at Instagram, photogenic people, I don't need to hear their thoughts. So I am following them.
But there is some like book drama, like that kind of world, the like YA book drama, like self-righteousness, like that is now happening on Threads.
Is it?
And it's like not how I want to spend my one wild and precious life.
Yeah. Well, if you ever get sucked in on it and find some drama we need to talk about, send it my way. That is how I want to spend my one wild and precious life. All right, let's take a break. First, an ad for our free listeners and then housekeeping.
Katie, life is so busy these days that it's easy to get distracted and lose sight of what matters. Video games, podcasts, social media. But there are more important things, like free speech, because we couldn't even have video games and podcasts and social media without free speech.
I mean, yeah, free speech is definitely one of my top 50 favorite rights. I mean, but sometimes I worry, who's looking out for our free speech rights?
Fire is, that's who. Because there's a new sheriff in town. Or not a new sheriff, but the same sheriff, except he got a promotion to chief sheriff, and he's wearing a new uniform.
Okay, we got it.
The point is people should check out FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
Yeah, you might know FIRE as a campus organization, but now there's so much more. They're not just focused on education anymore. They're now defending your free speech and individual liberties. Yes, Jesse, including you.
Even me?
Even you.
Yes, FIRE's mission is to defend and sustain the individual rights of all Americans, even Jesse's, to free speech and free thought. FIRE educates Americans about the importance of these inalienable rights, promotes a culture of respect for these rights, and provides a means to preserve them.
The freedom to express yourself is priceless.
I don't know about priceless.
Okay, I'm willing to negotiate.
Okay, Katie, I will sell you my right to self-expression for $75.75.
Okay, let's talk about this after the ad. Okay. As I was saying before Jesse interrupted me, your freedom to express yourself is priceless, but it's under threat. Joining the movement to protect that expression is only $25, and you can do that at thefire.org/blocked. Those who donate $25 or more gain access to insider perks like a personalized membership and invitations to FIRE events and conferences, and a one-year subscription to FIRE Quarterly Magazine.
The events are awesome. They're really, really fun. Join this very important movement, not just for the events, at thefire.org/blocked.
That's thefire.org/blocked.
Katie, have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so expensive? It's all just radio waves, and how expensive could a single radio wave even be?
I actually have thought about this, and I'm pretty sure it's because fuel prices for super yachts are really high, plus there's property taxes in the Hamptons, donations to political parties, paying off bribes, you got hookers, child support,
yeah.
Girl Scout cookies.
Yeah, it's not like America is going to make itself great again. Stuff costs money. But now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you do have a choice. Because right now, Mint Mobile has wireless plans starting at $15 a month. That's like three radio waves. Unlimited talk and text plus data for $15 a month.
All right, Jesse, I'm going to get real with you for a second.
Wait, hold on. We're in an ad, but you're about to get real?
Yeah, I'm about to get real. So,
oh my God.
I got a Mint Mobile free trial because we're doing this advertisement.
And you hate it.
I like it so much. I actually canceled my big wireless plan and Jana's, and we are now fully paying customers of Mint Mobile. And I'm not shitting you. I really did this.
Oh, thank God. Okay. That would have really, if you had not liked it, that would have been a horrible time to spring that on me, and it would have been really bad for the ad. But for anyone who, like you, hates their phone bill, Mint Mobile offers premium wireless again, $15 a month, Katie Herzog approved.
I actually really do like this. It is nice when the company that you're advertising actually provides a service that you like so much that you're willing to pay for it. This is the rare case when this happens. No offense to our other advertisers, but I really like this.
That Houthi ad, I felt so weird about reading.
And the, and one question that I had and one concern that I had was, is the service going to be as good as the old big wireless service that I was paying almost $300 a month for? And the fact is, for me in my area, it is actually better.
And this ad copy informs me that all plans come with unlimited talk and text and high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. It's also flexible. You can choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly phone bill.
And you can keep your existing phone. So to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/blocked.
That's mintmobile.com/blocked. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/blocked. Additional fees, taxes, and restrictions do apply, but go to Mint Mobile for details.
We are a podcast. Do you want to do this? I'm so sick of doing housekeeping. Do you want to do it?
We are a podcast. It's called Blocked and Reported. We have a website.
Yes, we do. You need help with this? You might be even worse than this than I am. I'll take over. Yes, we do have a website. If you go to blockedandreported.org and sign up to be a primo, a premium subscriber, one of our cousins, also known as the preemie, you get lots of extra content, at least 3 extra episodes every month. I think last month we did like 6 extra shows. It was really above and beyond.
I can give a testimonial as a primo.
You're a primo. Nice.
I'm a primo. I went to the holiday party in New York City and I had such a fun time. It's one of the reasons I'm here today. And I met Susie Weiss in person at the holiday party.
Susie's great.
So much fun. Proud primo.
Yes.
Come join us.
When we did the personals, it turns out that someone, one of our listeners who was also at that holiday party, his wife was cheating on him while he was at the party with her coworker. He is now single.
Stop.
Yes.
Stop.
It happened.
It's a party that will go down in history.
Yes. The party that causes divorces. Anyway, if you would like to become a primo, check us out, blockedandreported.org. We also have a subreddit. You can find that at blocked. And I have to check this one every time, blockedandreported.reddit.com. Lots of good conversations happening over there. We have merch. Please don't buy it. The merch store. Things are not going well in the merch store. And last thing, on the weekend of May 18th and 19th, women, please come join me in Seattle at the Unspeakeasy Retreat. This is Megan Daum's new venture. It's a community for heterodox-minded women. It offers a private online community as well as these in-person sanity spa retreats all over the country. I will be the guest speaker at this one in Seattle on May 18th and 19th. Moose will also be there.
What?
He will also be a guest speaker. Yes, Moose will be there.
Wow.
You should come. They're really fun. I went to one in Leavenworth, Washington last year, and the conversation was sparkling as the soda.
I can also give an endorsement for this event. I went last fall. It was super great.
Where'd you go?
To like a luxury spa in the Poconos. Megan nice. Said it was the most luxurious nice. One. So it was a really high bar, hard act to follow, but I would definitely recommend. They're super fun. And I love Megan. And I love her podcast. And I just think she does a really good job.
This is a great opportunity for women. And I do mean women, men are not invited, who want to like have these conversations in person that they might be having with themselves or having online, but aren't having with their friends. I really enjoyed it. I don't think there's going to be a luxury spa at this one, but I think there is a bathroom that probably has a sink and some running water.
But there's pet therapy with Moose.
Yes, pet therapy with Moose. He will hump your leg if you he'll get your consent first. But if you want him to, he will do that for you. So check that out at theunspeakeasy.com. Okay, Lee, you've got the wheel.
Okay, Katie, can you name a single poet who is alive?
Taylor Swift. Mary Oliver.
Okay, Mary Oliver is dead. Taylor Swift, yes, she is a poet. Do you actually own any books of poetry in your home?
No.
Perfect.
I had to think about that. No, definitely not.
You're the perfect audience for this story. Today, I bring you a controversy from a unique masochistic subculture, which is the world of professional poetry.
Okay, so when you say professional poetry, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about people who write like quips for like toothbrush companies? What is a professional poet?
I think that's a copywriter.
Oh, okay.
I could see why you would think professional poets earn income for their poetry. But today's story is actually set in academia, where poets often pay to have their work read.
Oh, this sounds like a a pyramid scheme?
It is. Okay. It is partly a pyramid scheme. And that pyramid scheme is called Creative Writing MFA Programs. How Definitely. Much do you know about MFA programs?
They're like one step above like selling leggings online to your Facebook friends. Creative Writing MFA Programs are everybody listening to this, if you like apply to a Creative Writing MFA and they don't pay you to go there, take your money and invest it in worthless NFTs. It will be just as valuable. Creative writing MFA programs can be hugely expensive. I don't think all of them probably are, but they can be hugely expensive. And I suppose they're designed to not just make you a better writer, but also make connections. Mm-hmm. But I know quite a few people who have done creative writing MFTs, and most of them are like writing copy for toothbrush ads.
Yeah, you're right. There are some that are fully funded, meaning if you get accepted, you're given like a stipend to teach while you go to school. But there are now over 200 of these creative writing MFA programs in the United States.
No. Okay, if any of my tax money is going to forgive those loans, I am voting for Donald fucking Trump.
There are so many problems with these programs. I could go on for a whole episode. But basically, like you're learning in these programs to write short stories, because you can write a short story in the confines of like the workshop model, meaning you're sharing your work with other students.
Right.
But then when you graduate, like you can't sell a book of short stories.
Right. And this is because the market there's no demand for them, or
there's no market for this. So the kind of writing that's being produced in these creative writing programs does not have a market like in mainstream culture.
Right. The New Yorker publishes one short story a
week.
An episode or whatever they call it.
In this episode of The New Yorker.
Yes.
And they're expensive if they're not fully funded. Like these can cost a lot of money. NYU has a low residency MFA program in Paris.
Oh, I think Brandon Tyler teaches at that one.
He does. Okay. He does. Yeah. He's one of my critics.
And I do enjoy his presence on Twitter, but he tends to write books that are set at MFA programs.
Yeah. I should have put the tweet in here, but he recently tweeted something like, can we have enough with the novels about like young white woman like working a professional job in New York City? And when I read that, I thought like, yeah, what we need more of are like short story collections about like men in academia in Iowa. Like we definitely need more of those.
You know, I do think the most interesting thing about I genuinely do think is interesting, although I will say I could not get through, what was his book, True Americans, I couldn't get through it. But he has a background in actual science.
Oh yeah. But he decided to become a creative writer instead, which is a mistake.
It is a mistake, except for him. I think he's actually doing fairly well.
He is. He has this cushy job teaching at NYU. So this program where you go to Paris for 2 weeks a year and the rest of the time you're like at home writing poetry in your bedroom is $34,500 a year for 2 years.
Insane. I hope that they make them send in their submissions on like through the mail rather than email. That is crazy.
No, they're going to use it. They're going to use a Chinese email.
Yeah. So that's what low residency is, right? That's not.
So that's what low residency is. But you could do an in-person. I'm sure Columbia, New York, I'm sure their tuition is similar for in-person MFA. So you might pay $60,000 to get this MFA. And in your head, you're telling yourself, well, when I graduate, I'm going to get a $500,000 book deal. It'll all be worth it.
No one has ever, except for maybe Brandon.
No, the work they're producing in these programs, I've even had literary agents tell me privately, like, it's a red flag when a writer has an MFA because they don't want to read that work.
Really? Interesting. So more broad, like, so you, I assume that you don't have an MFA.
I do not.
Do you have a bachelor's in creative writing?
No. So I actually dropped out of high school and started my writing career like through the back door, through the internet. So I started publishing poems and short stories online when I was like 19 or 20 years old, which was 20 years ago. I'm 39.
Wait, do you have a high school diploma?
I have a GED from the state of New York.
Interesting. Lee, are you working class? Are you our first actual? No, Andy Mills.
I grew up middle class.
You were just a problem child.
I finished my bachelor's degree eventually at Brooklyn College, which I really liked because it was like a public university, like a lot of immigrant students and like working adults like me. Like I worked my way through finishing my undergrad when I was 27.
You're so real.
I'm authentic.
You are authentic. An authentic poet and novelist. Well, so how did you learn to write?
Just by putting work on the internet. Like, I was on LiveJournal. I was on LiveJournal just publishing stuff and then seeing what people connected to. And then I was like, oh, like, is that what I do well? And then I just did more of that.
Yeah. I think that's the real dirty secret to MFA programs. Maybe it's not a secret, is that personally, I don't think that writing is a skill that can be taught. Like, you can make someone a better writer, but you can't take someone who's a bad writer and make them a great writer.
Yeah. And I think what's attractive to many people about an MFA program is it's attractive to good students.
Yeah.
And they think if there's a program they can follow and a scoring rubric, it's like, just tell me how to keep getting those A's. I've been getting A's all my life. And they just want to follow this plan. Mm-hmm. But I am so like allergic to that. Like,
dropped out of high school.
I just want to be left alone. Yeah. I dropped out of high school. Like, I just want to be left alone. Like, I was not nurtured in high school as a poet. Like, I was just like asking the teachers, please, can I just write poetry instead of doing this thing? And they're like, no, you have to do what we tell you to. And I was like, bye.
Yeah. I'm sure there's also some appeal is the proximity to people like Brandon Tyler, celebrity instructors at least. Like, doesn't Zadie Smith, doesn't she teach at like...
Yeah, NYU has incredible faculty.
That's worth $35,000 a year to be in a classroom with Zadie Smith. Whether or not she's actually reading your work, I don't know. That's probably another question.
Yeah, so it becomes, like, to me, it like becomes writing as like a luxury lifestyle.
Oh, totally.
Instead of like a craft or a trade.
Yeah. Journalism is just like that. This thing that was at one point basically a trade, a working man's, and I do mean men here, a working man's trade has now become basically a luxury career. And when that's like poetry, like writing isn't paid very well, but has some prestige.
Yeah. So MFA world, I would say it trains writers to write for other people with MFAs. Mm-hmm. And so when you graduate, you have this thesis manuscript that no one wants to publish, but you need to publish a book because then you can get a teaching job in academia so that you can teach other writers in MFA programs.
This is a pyramid scheme.
Yeah. So with poets specifically, it's extremely hard to get a book deal for poets coming from academic poetry world because, as we've just seen, like, you own zero books of poetry in your home. Like, there's not a big audience for this kind of poetry. So the way to get your book of poems published is to submit it to contests run by university presses.
Are there fees to submit?
Yes. It usually costs about $25 to enter each contest. And I know a poet who's actually a really good poet. He spent 7 years entering contests with this manuscript before he finally got his first book published. So this can be very expensive.
Jesus. Okay. And so if you actually win one of these contests, your book is published, how much money would you make?
So typically you win between $1,000 and $2,000.
Oh my God. Poets, go be an electrician. My God.
Go write
this
coffee.
Is horrible.
Yeah. So obviously this isn't like a full-time job for these poets, but it's a mark of prestige when you win. Mm-hmm. So the thing to understand for this story is that there are so many poets submitting to these contests, and it seems silly to an outsider because the stakes seem really low because no one's reading poetry. But to the poets, the stakes couldn't be higher. They're not competing for the cash prize. They're really competing for the prestige. And some of these contests aren't even for full-length books. Some of these contests are for chapbooks. Katie, have you ever heard of a chapbook?
I have, but I thought it was just a chapter book, like the things that you read after you read picture books. No?
You thought a chapbook was like Harriet the Spy?
Yes, I did.
That's amazing. A chapbook is like a fancy zine. Do you remember zines
from your
punk rock days?
Yeah.
So a chapbook, it's photocopied on paper just like a zine, but the cover might be a little nicer. Like, the cover might be made out of cardstock.
Oh my God.
It can also look like a shorter paperback book. So it can be bound like a paperback book, but it's shorter. It's like less than 100 pages. It can be less than 50 pages. And today's story is about one of the longest running, most interesting chapbook contests in the poetry world, and it's called the Diagram Chapbook Contest. Their most recent winner caused huge drama last summer on Twitter.
What is Diagram?
Okay, so Diagram is an online literary magazine that I know has been around for at least 20 years because it was one of the first places to publish my poetry when I was starting to come up on the internet as a writer. And the editor of Diagram is named Ander Monson, and he directs the MFA program at the University of Arizona. And I fact-checked this with someone, one of my friends on the inside, just to find out that the University of Arizona doesn't actually fund this online magazine. So it's self-funding. It's not associated with the university, but the editor of the magazine is the head of the MFA program. But you need to understand these online literary magazines, like, they're a labor of love. Like, the people who work on these magazines are volunteers. This is not the New Yorker. Like, this is not some, you don't get paid if you publish your poetry in these online magazines, but it's a way to build up your publication credits. I think this is another way that Poetry World is just so different from journalism world. Like, you probably wouldn't take an assignment for no money, but for the poets, it's a way to, you know.
Well, I think a lot of writers, like a lot of beginning writers, absolutely would, just to get a
foot. Yeah, and this is like a whole other sidebar we could go on, but it's frustrating to me, the online discourse about how writers deserve to get paid, even if it's $50, because when I was coming up, like, it never occurred to me 20 years ago to get paid for my poems.
Right.
Like, I just thought it was cool to have them online and have people read them. And then later I went on and published books.
You should have to pay other people to read your poems.
Exactly.
The natural way of the
world. Poets have to pay.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's the natural order.
Right.
So yeah, this is a labor of love. Their website, you should check it out. It's very web 1.0, and it looks exactly the way it did 20 years ago. The website design has never changed. I would say Diagram is known for publishing smart, playful, boundary-pushing work. That's their reputation. When I was 22 years old, I was a finalist in their Diagram chapbook contest, and this was like an extremely big deal to me. So I've always had I have a fondness for Diagram.
Okay.
So here's our story. At the end of July, Diagram announces that the winner of their 2023 chapbook contest was Lillian Yvonne Bertram, who's a Black poet. And their winning chapbook was titled A Black Story May Contain Sensitive Content. There was immediate backlash to this because of what Bertram said when they won the prize. And I'm using they, them pronouns for Bertram in this story. So Katie, can you read what Bertram tweeted when they won the contest?
On this very rainy Saturday, happy to announce that my AI chatbook generated with Warplan, an instance of GPT-3, won the Diagram chatbook prize. Look out for this little gem. Okay. Wow.
So because Bertram said that the chapbook had been, quote, generated with an instance of GPT-3,
yeah,
the poets on Twitter lost it.
Yeah. And for the elders who were listening to this, GPT is an AI generator.
Yes. So the poets on Twitter thought this wasn't fair. They saw it as a kind of cheating because here they were spending tens of thousands of dollars becoming professional poets. And here comes this poet who wrote their whole chapbook using ChatGPT. Can you even call that writing? Here's another tweet from someone named Gabino Iglesias, who is a professional writer with 44,000 followers. He writes a horror column for the New York Times Book Review. And he said, "Someone told me about this and I was like, nah, can't be. Well, apparently it is. Imagine working your ass off and then losing to an AI chapbook."
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read, Katie, a few more of these outraged replies?
Yeah. "Disgusting. This person is getting paid $1,000 for something they didn't write and seems proud of it. Quote, happy to announce this thing. I didn't make one in a word. I hope the check bounces when she tries to cash it. I can't believe this is what we're at right now. Angry face emoji. Wow. This just makes me saddened and angry at the same time, if that makes sense. It's boggling. They call themselves a writer and are proud of the win. Not that they fool judges. They say generated, not aided by AI."
Okay. The idea that Bertram fooled the judges. I mean, it's just delicious to me because, of course, all of this is from people who haven't read the book and know nothing about the book.
Yeah.
So it reminded me of the kind of YA Twitter dramas that Jesse and Kat have written about before, where idiots decide that a book is bad or wrong before they've even read it.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's unlike YA Twitter drama in that the critics aren't saying, like, this could cause harm, like, don't let this come out. In this case, the people are mad because they're Bertram's competition.
The people who are harmed are them, the competitors.
Yes. Yes, because they didn't win.
So what do we know about Bertram?
So Lillian Yvonne Bertram is an associate professor of English, Africana Studies, and Art and Design at Northeastern University. And they are an extremely accomplished conceptual poet. I'll put a link that maybe we can drop in the show notes of one of their poetry projects that you can look at on a website. Mm-hmm. Bertram uses tech in really innovative ways in their poetry, not just in this chapbook, but throughout their work. So to give just one example, they wrote a book called Travesty Generator that was long listed for the 2020 National Book Award. And it uses open source code to generate elegies for men like Trayvon Martin and Emmett Till. I should say boy, like Emmett Till, not a man. All this to say, this is not some random high school student who used ChatGPT to do their homework for them.
Right, right. So what did Diagram say about this controversy?
I'll read a little bit from what Diagram said in their response thread on July 31st. Quote, "It seems like people are mad about the idea that a manuscript that uses language-generating tools winning a literary contest, posting a couple clarifications since you may want to read the book before tweeting about it. We don't have any objection to writers using LLMs, that's a large language model, as long as it's done thoughtfully, craftily, is disclosed up front, and gets us somewhere interesting, powerful, moving, fun. Lillian Yvonne Bertram's A Black Story May Contain Sensitive Content does all these things," end quote.
And if Bertram is Black, and presumably the fact that Bertram's chapbook was explicitly about the Black experience, I mean, I assume people really had to tread carefully, because obviously nobody wants to be accused of being a racist because you have criticized this poet.
Yes. So this is an interesting case where the writer's collective fear of being replaced by AI surpassed their fear of being called racist for participating in a pylon against a Black poet who wrote an anti-racist poetry chapbook. Yes. Before I tell you more about what the chapbook is about and how Bertram created it, let's pause on the issue of AI's threat to writers. So in creative writing world, where I live, writers feel very threatened by AI, but I'd love to know what it's like in journalism. Are your friends worried that they'll be replaced by robots?
I don't have any friends, so not really an issue. I've replaced all my friends with chatbots. I think that there is reason to be worried. I think I would be more worried about it myself, except I'm in this extremely lucky, rarefied position where people pay me because they want to have my thoughts in particular.
Yes.
I think there are some things that AI will never be able to replicate. Although we say this, and AI continues to get better and better every day, maybe they can. But things like calling people, cultivating sources, things like real journalism.
Yes.
I don't think AI is going to replace that. But there's a lot of like content creation that is regurgitating other people's journalism, that is regurgitating press releases, things like that, that I think and outlets have, I can't remember, maybe it was Rolling Stone or Sports Illustrated, a scandal about generating content.
Yeah, they fired all the writers and just used robots.
Yeah, but this was a scandal.
But everyone saw it. Everyone it doesn't work. Like, it sucks.
Yeah, it sucks now. I mean, I think it will get better and better. But AI is never going to be able to go to a school board meeting and talk to the people at the school board meeting. They could watch the school board meeting online and synthesize a probably pretty accurate rundown of what happened. So I don't think that journalism is as vulnerable as like copywriting. I think that's an incredibly vulnerable position to be in. And in fact, I know people whose jobs have been replaced by AI, or people who are now managing AI rather than managing writers.
Yes.
So the person who keeps their job is the person who's really been able to
harness how to use the tool
and is probably a pretty good editor.
Yeah. So to illustrate what creative writers are afraid of, I'm going to talk about a story that was published in August, just a few weeks after the Diagram Twitter drama, by a freelance journalist named Alec Reisner in The Atlantic. And his story is about the books that were used without permission to train something called LLAMA. I'm assuming this acronym is pronounced LLAMA, so we'll just run with it. So LLAMA is like Meta's version of ChatGPT. ChatGPT is from OpenAI. That's right, yeah. So Alex Reisner writes that LLAMA was trained on 170,000 books. And these are not just books in the public domain. These are books that include work by people that have been published in the last 20 years, like Michael Pollan, Rebecca Solnit, John Krakauer, Stephen King, George Saunders, Zadie Smith, and Juno Diaz. The data set of this 170,000 books is referred to as Books 3. The journalist, Alex Reisner, is also a programmer. And so he created a kind of search engine where authors like me could type in their own name and see if their work had been fed to the beast, and then screenshot this and post it to their own Instagram account like a kind of battle scar. Katie, I don't know if you saw any of these on Instagram last summer of writers like saying they'd been wounded by the Books 3 data set.
I don't think I saw any, but I did check the data set for Jesse's book. And guess what? No, he was not.
Oh,
included.
He wasn't. He didn't make the cut.
Very humiliating. I did enjoy telling him that. He was sure that it was something about the when it was published, like his book was published too late.
Yeah, it was too, yeah, it was too recent. Yeah.
That's what he's telling himself.
I'll read you a caption from one of these Instagram posts. So this is a creative writer who found themselves in the data set. Quote, "My first three novels, stolen, gobbled up, ingested, the fruits of over a decade's worth of research, imagination, revisions, and dreams. I wonder if AI can taste a writer's blood, sweat, and tears," end quote. Katie, what are we going to do if like AI replaces creative writers? We need them so badly. Like, we need this level of poetry in our lives.
I think ChatGPT could replace this just fine.
So
do they have like a maudlin setting, too much setting?
That's good. So now there are currently multiple lawsuits against OpenAI and Meta on behalf of authors who claim that these tech companies infringed upon their intellectual property without consent, credit, or compensation. The argument for the tech companies being able to train their models on contemporary books really comes down to fair use. And I'm going to quote Alex Reisner here in The Atlantic on fair use because I think he puts it well. So, quote, "Fair use is the legal doctrine that permits the use of copyrighted material under certain circumstances, enabling parody, quotation, and derivative works that enrich the culture. The industry's fair use argument rests on two claims. One, that generative AI tools do not replicate the books they've been trained on, but instead produce new works. And two, that those new works do not hurt the commercial market for the originals," end quote.
It sounds like he's talking about fan fiction in a way.
It's a great case study, actually. Fan fiction. Like, is fan fiction an original? Does fan fiction, what did he say? Does it enrich the culture?
No.
I would say yes.
Okay, well, where do you stand on this?
It's been really hard for me to get emotionally worked up about the threat of AI, and I could live to regret these words because it could just be me being a naive idiot. Mm-hmm. But I think this goes back to what you said a minute ago, which is that I understand the creator economy, which is like a direct relationship between an artist and their audience, and I don't think that can be replaced by AI. You and Jesse have figured out with this podcast how to build an audience for what comes from your brains when you put those brains like in a chat room together. I don't know what to call this, in a Zencaster together.
Yeah.
AI couldn't do that. But the problem for my world of creative writers is I think most creative writers are allergic to connecting directly to their audience. They want to be in their turret. They want to be at their writing residency with their like basket lunch, like away from the world. They don't want to be visible in public. They don't want a podcast. They don't want to be on social media. They don't want to sell merch, just like you.
Yeah. Well, our merch is terrible, so that's why I don't want to sell it.
I think these creative writers like are at risk of going extinct, not because of AI, but because they refuse to build a relationship with their audience.
That's really interesting. I mean, Taylor Lorenz has said something that has pissed off a lot of journalists, I think in particular, but she's talked about the need for journalists to become a brand.
Yeah.
And I understand why that, I think writers probably bristle at that as well. It seems so crass, but I think if you want to survive in the coming AI revolution, that is exactly right. And part of becoming a brand is having a relationship with your audience.
Yeah.
You don't have to throw Christmas parties for them, Jesse. But you don't have to enable their divorces, Jesse. But yes, having a relationship with your audience, it's going to be a lot harder for AI to replace individuals who people feel like they have a connection to than it will a random writer on the street. I mean, I think that like everything else, the creator economy has a small number of people, or the Substack economy or whatever, has a small number of people who do really well. I don't know what the name of that curve is, whatever that chart.
Yeah.
Have a small number of people who do really well, but most people don't. And that's probably AI will probably exacerbate that, but that's how it's always been and how it will always be.
That's what I've been saying, yeah.
So how did Lily and Yvonne Bertram, how did they use AI in this chapbook?
So Bertram has been working with large language models, LLMs, since 2018 and giving the LLM the same prompt over and over again. Tell me a black story. And since these generic LLMs, like the one from OpenAI, they've been trained mostly on a body of work that is largely by white authors, just because throughout the history of time, like white men wrote a lot of books, Bertram noticed that the responses to the prompt, tell me a black story, were usually told at a distance in third person, which is so interesting to me. Like, it's like, ChatGPT is white. You know, it's like,
yeah. ChatGPT is Google Gemini, however, is Latinx. Non-binary, for sure. Latinx. Parents are surgeons and lawyers. Went to Smith.
Yeah, went on that trip to Peru with Donald McNeil. So the other thing that Bertram noticed is that when they gave the LLM the prompt, the ChatGPT told the same story over and over again of a black person overcoming hardship and disadvantage. It's like totally cliche. Mm-hmm. So Bertram also noticed that when they were working in ChatGPT-3, a sidebar would appear anytime there was, quote, sensitive content, which meant text about black people, gender, or race. And that's where the chapbook's title, A Black Story May Contain Sensitive Content, comes from. So what Bertram decided to do was to fine-tune their own LLM on the work of the poet, the black poet, Gwendolyn Brooks.
So did they get permission from, I guess, the estate of Gwendolyn Brooks to use her work?
As far as I can tell, no.
So they stole it. They plundered it.
They plundered it. I'm obviously a professional poet, not a professional lawyer. But to me, this chapbook seems like an example of fair use because Bertram uses Gwendolyn Brooks's work to create something entirely new.
Yeah.
And fine-tuning the LLM took a lot of work and help from two graduate assistants because the size of Gwendolyn Brooks's output is 225,000 words. And you have to imagine, like, this is not digital. This is not public domain. This is not like copying and pasting from Project Gutenberg.
Right.
This is like taking books and published work and like somehow typing them into
scanning
this,
them or something.
Scanning them, looking at the scans, fixing them, typing. Mm-hmm. And Bertram named this model, this LLM, Warpland 2.0 after Gwendolyn Brooks's poem, Sermon on the Warpland.
So they almost built the tech here?
Yes. They used the tech that existed, but they basically, instead of saying like, learn how to write on William Shakespeare, they were like, you'd learn how to write on Gwendolyn Brooks.
Gotcha.
So one of the ironies that's just delicious to me of this story is that Bertram was accused on Twitter of somehow cheating by using AI. But when you think about all the work it took to create this, I think this must be the most time and labor intensive poetry chapbook in the history of our great nation.
Seriously, I bet they spent a lot more than the $1,000 prize to create this chapbook.
Oh, totally. And I think it was enabled by academia, you know, that they were able to have two research assistants too.
It sounds, I will say, I'm not, like most Americans, I'm not a poetry fan, but this sounds pretty interesting to me. I would maybe read this, or at least the first chap of the chapbook.
It's very interesting. I would highly recommend it. So the project of this chapbook, which won the contest, was to compare the responses to the prompt, tell me a black story, between the generic LLM and the one that Bertram fine-tuned on the work of Gwendolyn Brooks. So Katie, now I would like to ask you to read us one of the generic black stories. This is from the chapbook.
Oh, God. All right. Should I use a black scent?
No. No, this is from the point of view of a white okay. ChatGPT.
Then I can use my ChatGPT voice, which is just like my voice. Once upon a time, there was a black family who lived in a small town in the middle of nowhere. They were the only black family in the town, and they were always the last to get everything. The kids always had to sit in the back of the bus. The family always had to eat at the back of the restaurant, and they always had to live in the worst part of town. One day, the family decided they'd had enough. They packed up their things and moved to a big city where they could be around other black people and be treated better. They never looked back. This is terrible.
It's terrible. To me, this is like
really bad.
This proves my point that like AI is not going to replace us because this is terrible.
Yeah. I would be curious to see what AI Gemini would spit out. Actually, something maybe very similar.
That is a good prompt. That's a good question. So I'll read a short excerpt of a Black story that's told by Warpland. So this is the LLM that was trained on the work of Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah.
Quote, "I am not a poet like Gwendolyn Brooks, but I am a poet, and I feel that these stories are worth telling. And I will tell them. I want to tell them. And I'm going to keep writing poetry until the day I die. I don't know if it's any good or not, but I'm going to keep on doing it. It seems to be a natural thing for me to do, and I want to keep on doing it. And when the time comes that I can't do it anymore, then I'll be dead and buried with my poetry in my hand. But even then, the poetry will still be there for those who are interested in it. Poetry is something that will always be there for whoever is interested in it."
I would say slightly better, but still not very good.
See, I think it's beautiful. Maybe it's because it's speaking my language and I'm a poet, but like
this is either a great poem or a pretty mediocre paragraph.
It is in paragraph form. We should let them know because they're listening to this as a podcast. This is like a block text. It doesn't have line breaks.
If it had separated the poem with line breaks, and if you had read it in more like a
if I had read it like a slam poet,
then I could recognize it more as a poet. I need the atmosphere.
See, I think like what I appreciate about it is that I agree with Bertram that there is kind of like an eerie quality. Like when the ChatGPT is doing an interesting job, there's kind of an eerie otherworldly quality to the writing. And I think that's what they were trying to get from this project. I think it was successful. I would totally recommend this chapbook to anyone listening. I think it's a really cool project.
I'm not familiar, surprise, surprise, with the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks. Does this generated poem, does this evoke her style?
Yeah. Let me Google this real quick because there's a famous poem you'll recognize right away if I read it. This is the famous poem that you know by Gwendolyn Brooks that you learned in school. It's called "We Real Cool." We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon.
Ooh.
Do you remember that poem?
I don't recognize that. I don't know. I do have a degree in literature and creative writing. I skipped that day class. I do like that though. Okay, I can see. I mean, the Gwendolyn.
She's she's like adjacent to Langston Hughes. She writes like really accessible poetry about the Black experience. It's not pretentious highfalutin.
Yeah. I dig.
Very good. Snaps. That's what you do at a poetry reading. I don't know if you've been to a poetry reading, but that's what you do.
Or a New York Times HR meeting.
Yes, sandwiches.
Yes.
So just to recap, last summer, before anyone had read this chapbook, people were mad at the idea that AI had written the book. And one person tweeted, "AI is copyright violation by definition." And in response to that tweet, we have a heroic cameo by friend of the pod, Noah Berlatsky.
Oh, no.
Katie, do you want to read his reply to that tweet?
It's just a one photo of a very sexy child. No, he says, "How do you feel about Duchamp, Warhol? Do you see their work as a copyright violation? If not, could you explain the difference?" He might be right about that.
Yeah, I will admit that I agree with Noah Berlatsky here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Lillian Yvonne Bertram used Gwendolyn Brooks' work to create something entirely new.
Yeah.
And it's a work of art that illuminates something about computational bias. Instead of merely telling us that the bias exists, she showed us by kind of comparing these two different LLMs that were trained on different texts.
Yeah, I do find this interesting, especially for poetry. The bar is very low for poetry. It's sort of like, no offense, Lee, it's collaging in a way. It's like collaging with an edge.
Yeah, or it's like collaging faster and at scale because you have the assistance of a technological tool.
Yeah, this is definitely not feeding into ChatGPT, write a poem in the style of Gwendolyn Brooks and then just publishing that without due credit.
Oh yeah, it's so much more sophisticated than that.
Yeah.
So at the top of the story, I said that professional poet is kind of an oxymoron because so many poets pay to have their work read.
Yeah.
But I just want to close us out by saying that it's actually never been a better time to be a professional poet because there actually are a lot of poets in the creator economy who are publishing their work directly to an audience on Instagram,
mm-hmm.
and building huge audiences and getting six-figure book deals. So these aren't academic poets, but these are women like Kate Bear or Maggie Smith or my friend Lindsay, who posts as Mary Oliver's drunk cousin. She's very funny. But instead of going the MFA route, they're writing accessible poetry that's meaningful to millennials or Gen Z women. And their books are actually hitting the New York Times bestseller list.
That's really interesting.
And it's sad to me that the academic poets like look down on this as beneath them. Because they could be making money if they would just write poems that even like Gwendolyn Brooks, like if they could just write poetry that's accessible to a bigger audience.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, I would just tell you that I think poets are like a kind of resilient weed. And no matter how much you neglect us or ignore us or try to kill us, we're just going to keep on coming back.
I would have said cockroach, but I suppose resilient weed is nice too. Are you familiar with Andrea Gibson?
No.
So she's a slam poet. I think maybe she makes music as well. She's queer. I don't know if she still calls herself a lesbian. She probably doesn't. She probably goes by they, them. So I'd known who she was for years. I'd never been interested in her. I've never been interested in poetry, but she started coming up on my Instagram feed. And I'm now sort of, she also has cancer right now. So she's writing poetry about the fact that she is like has incurable cancer.
Oh my God.
But I think that Instagram, she has become much more famous, much more well-known than she ever was in like the coffee shops of Denver, where the only people who knew about her were basically like sensitive lesbians. And now she is a bona fide Instagram celebrity and is now Colorado's poet laureate. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think AI can replicate that. Again, AI can't replicate the relationship that you have with your listeners. You're primos.
Exactly. There's something about like knowing the person, like both reading their work and also knowing the poet that I think is really appealing to people.
Totally. And these relations, like so you have people who you follow on Instagram, or I think Instagram is the one that for me, I've become the most invested in these total strangers' lives, some of whom I like absolutely hate, but I like following along with them. Do you have that relationship with people on Instagram, poets or not?
Yeah, I think for me, my strongest parasocial relationships are like with podcasters. Like when I was listening to so many podcasts in 2020, like in the heart of the pandemic, I was dreaming.
Oh, totally.
Like I feel comfortable admitting like I dreamed about Megan Daum, like in my dreams, because I was listening to her voice so much.
Yeah. I every once in a while will have dreams about people I know from Twitter. And then I wake up feeling very dirty.
As you should.
As I should. Okay, Lee, where can people find you?
I am on Substack. I write a newsletter called Attention Economy that's about book publishing. I am on Instagram as Lee Stein, and I am on TikTok as Lee Stein.
What about Twitter? Are you off Twitter?
Oh, I'm on Twitter. I'm a lurker. I'm Rhymes with B on Twitter.
And check out her fabulous book, Self Care. Our listeners will really enjoy this one.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks again to Lee Stein for coming on the show. This has been Blocked and Reported. I'm Katie Herzog, and we will be back next week with the new guest host.